on the platform.
Okay. We have to start. Let me put the let me officially open the meeting of the Standing Committee on Finance. Welcome members of the committee. Welcome the support team of Parliament, including the PBO, legal services and other services, and the media team from Parliament. Let me welcome the media in general. Welcome our stakeholders who are in the platform to make submissions orally and in a written form. Welcome National Treasury. Welcome FIC, SARS and other agencies of government and those entities that report to National Treasury. You are all welcome in the platform. Are there apologies?
No apologies received, Chair.
No, okay. No apology. We'll move to item two. Let me indicate that after the meeting we had last time to process submissions from stakeholders, we considered the request that we have to revise the time frames for public submission, because the stakeholders indicated that last time they had a very short time to prepare for submissions. So we have extended the time for submissions to the 25th of October. That's next week. And National Treasury will come back for the last time to respond to the final submissions. So today we felt that National Treasury should give preliminary responses, though we have extended until the 25th. And then on the 1st of November, the committee will consider the bill and process the bill clause by clause and adopt the report so that we submit that report to the National Assembly. So we'll try by all means to make sure that we move with the necessary speed, but not leave stakeholders and the South African public behind in processing this matter, because this is a very weighty matter for the country. Be that as it may, honorable members, I'm very disappointed that whilst we are busy processing this bill, a certain section of business in South Africa publishes a report, which report suggests that South Africa has got 85% probability of being grey listed. I don't know in whose interest is business publishing such a negative report. Which methodology have they applied to arrive at these percentages and why do they do that. This is a matter of national interest. It is very important that all of us, business, our social partners, labor, us as parliamentarians, and everybody work together to avoid grey listing. Because grey listing will have very dire consequences for the economy of this country and even for the image of South Africa internationally. If there is something that we would not like to happen to this country, it's for South Africa to be grey listed. So it's very disappointing that people don't come to this platform, to Parliament, and say, Parliament and government in general, can you do the following to try that the country should not be grey listed? Because if you publish such a report as business, it's like scoring an own goal for the country. So you are telling the world that grey list us. So why shouldn't they grey list you? It is very disappointing for such a constituency to do that. And I don't know why they do that. But I, for one, am very disappointed with their conduct. And all of us, South Africans, let's work together to avoid the grey listing of this country. We understand there are serious challenges, but they are not insurmountable to an extent that we can't deal with those challenges. Hence, we have got this platform and Treasury and other departments, because this is not a matter for Treasury alone. As you can see, the General Laws Amendment Bill also has to amend other five legislations. And those legislations are not Treasury legislations. The legislations on NPO belongs to Social Development, the Companies Act, and a whole range of other acts which are here. They belong to different portfolios. However, at executive level also, ministers and departments are working together to address all the issues of compliance to make sure that South Africa avoid to be grey listed. So I thought I should make this statement through this platform that we are not happy with the report published by business to canvass for South Africa to be grey listed. So let's proceed and request...
Chairperson, on a point of order, if I may.
Yeah.
Chairperson, I do not agree with your assessment of the report. I did, in fact, receive a copy of that report. It did not encourage grey listing at all. I read it very carefully. In fact, it was setting out the consequences of grey listing. It was not advocating for it, and I welcome that report, because what that report did was alert us to the possible consequences of grey listing. The way that I read it, it certainly never pointed fingers, although it could have, but did not. That is us. That is our function in Parliament, and we've said that already. I asked the minister whether there would be some single person in the presidency to coordinate between the National Treasury and the security cluster, and he was quite obtuse about that. But anyway, I won't belabor the point, but I just want to say I do not support your view on that report. I think it's very important for stakeholders, especially business and the banking sector, who will be heavily affected. Obviously, I completely agree with you, Chair. The last thing we want is grey listing. That's the very last thing that anybody wants, including every, I'm absolutely sure everybody in South Africa. So that we all united on. But the fact of the matter is that there's a big chance we will be grey listed. And then if we are, we've got to get off as fast as possible. because our economy will be impacted. And I think that is how I certainly read that report. I do think that there's been dithering on this process. I do think that, and I've said it before, but we can't dwell on the past. We must focus on getting a better future. So I just wanted to state that, Chair. I think that that report needs to be seen in context, and I think that it was extremely useful, especially to me, and I would highly recommend that every member of this committee reads it, and that, in fact, the authors come to Parliament and talk through it, because it was very valuable in my view. But as I said before, the last thing we want is grey listing. Nobody wants that for South Africa. Nobody's advocating for that. We're in this mess together, but we've got to get out of it as fast as possible. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. George. We welcome your views. That is your interpretation of that report, which is welcome. We have got a festival of ideas, and we also have our own interpretation of that report. And as you suggest, why don't they come to this platform and make their submissions in the interest of the country? Let's proceed and request Treasury to make a preliminary response to the submissions received on the General Laws Amendment Bill. Treasury, is it Vukile who's leading Treasury in this respect?
Yes, Chair. Thank you for allowing us to present an initial assessment of the submissions that we've received. There've been a significant number of them. Just before diving in, though, Chair, if you'd allow me, if I could just ask Janine to slide the slides with me, Chair, as well, while she does that, with me, Chair, are members of National Treasury, as well as the Financial Intelligence Center, with whom we have been coordinating and working through the various submissions as we've received them. Chair, I'm just seeing from the chat. Yeah, we're just, if you just bear with me just a second while we just get the presentation up. Great, fantastic, and we will just put that in presentation mode and start with the first slide. Great. So, Chair, we've as you may be aware, we received 43 submissions from members of the public. 30 of those 43 by last count were specifically from the NGO sector. So I think by my rough arithmetic, it should be around 70%. The general thread through the comments from that sector is the short period in which they've had to comment on the bill. Chair, at the start of the meeting, of course, you've outlined measures to accommodate that and broaden the comments period to allow for greater participation. Chair, the majority of the commentators that we've worked through support the bill. I think it's important to note that, and I think that aligns with the general sentiment that you outlined as well at the opening, that there is a collective desire to avoid grey listing, given a common understanding, but also a strengthening understanding of the consequences of grey listing. The commentators in general, as I say, Chair, support the objectives to address the technical compliance deficiency, which is what this omnibus bill does. You may recall from our introductory presentation that there are another set of measures that we need to concentrate on, which relates to effectiveness. So the mutual evaluation report is really seen as the general laws amendment bill as the measures to address this one or half of the aspects of the two-step process, as I outlined. Chair, the comments received have been very constructive, and we thank all the submitters who have assisted us in really enhancing some of the draft proposals to amend certain aspects contained in the draft bill. And we will now sort of go through those in quite a bit of detail, just providing a initial sense of the issues. But of course, in some aspects, Chair, you'll note that further refinements are being worked through. So let me stop there as a broad introduction, Chair. I'm going to pass over to Janine to take us through the specific comments. Later on, Chair, then I will present the overall from a high level policy perspective, our initial reactions to some of the interventions, particularly in relation to the MPO sectors, which you would have seen were the vast majority of the comments. And then lastly, Chair, we'll spend a bit of time unpacking some of the comments in relation to beneficial ownership. Thank you, Chair. Janine?
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable members and stakeholders and all present in the meeting this morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide some initial responses to the submissions that have been received so far. Our presentation this morning doesn't go into absolutely all of the submissions that were received. We have also submitted a detailed initial table of comments that contains responses to all of the submissions received. This presentation highlights some of the most key and frequent comments that were received during the process and provide some feedback on what have been identified as some of the key issues that have been raised in the submissions. So first we'll touch on a few of the general comments that were made about the bill as a whole. A number of commentators noted the importance of consistency and alignment of legislation. And in this regard, it was noted that there should be a single definition of beneficial owner in the Trust Property Control Act, the Companies Act, the Financial Sector Regulation Act, and the FIC Act. And that it was also noted in the proposed definitions that were contained in the table bill that by including a cross-reference to the definition of beneficial ownership in the Financial Intelligence Center Act may have some unintended consequences which should be considered, and perhaps that cross-referencing should be removed from the definition of beneficial ownership in the various other pieces of legislation. And it was also provided by a number of commentators that potentially the definition of beneficial ownership could possibly prescribe a threshold. So we note some of these comments, and we certainly agree, you know, the achievement of general consistency and alignment between the legislation that's being amended and that relates to beneficial ownership is very important overall. And so we certainly take those comments on board. We will be submitting some specific proposals for refinements to the definitions of beneficial ownership to the committee for consideration that will take into account all of the comments relating to the definition of beneficial ownership that have been received so far in the comments process, as well as subsequent comments that might be received. Another aspect that came across in a number of the submissions was regarding concerns in respect of the fragmentation of registers and the possibility to have quite a fragmented system. And so it was highlighted that, you know, there needs to be appropriate integration and alignment between the registers if there are multiple registers, or perhaps the beneficial ownership data standard included in the bill, which would ensure that the data is interoperable and not just between departments, but also internationally. And so that was proposed as a means to ensure that the system is really centralized and not fragmented. So we certainly note the importance and the concern about the fragmentation of the registers. And this is an aspect that is referred to the interdepartmental committee that's chaired by the National Treasury that is responsible for AML, CFT, proliferation financing policy. And it's not necessary to really explicitly provide for the central registration, centralization of the registers in the primary legislation. But we certainly note that the appropriate coordination of the registers is very important to ensure that the system will be able to be implemented effectively and the information will be accessible appropriately. So we note that the access to the various registers will be dealt with through regulations after consultation with all stakeholders, and it would be a process that would probably occur in a staged manner in line with the approach by most other FATF-compliant jurisdictions. And the design of the National Beneficial Ownership on Transparency Registries Framework is receiving the attention of the Governmental Working Group on Beneficial Ownership that is co-led by the DPSA and the FIC and constituted by the CIPC, the Master's Office, the FIC, and SARS. This framework is being attended to and it's focusing on the structural and technical design and implementation of the framework. And we will go into this in a bit more detail later in the presentation. The revised FATF interpretation note to recommendation 24 provides that companies should follow a multi-pronged approach and decide on the basis, risk, context, and materiality and what forms of registry or alternative mechanisms they will use to enable efficient access to information by all competent authorities. Companies should also be required to obtain and hold information on their own beneficial owners. And public authorities or bodies like tax authorities, companies registries, and beneficial ownership registries should also be required to hold beneficial ownership information. And the revised FATF recommendation 24 and the revised interpretation note do not necessarily require, you know, a single centralized register be held by one body. It can be held by multiple bodies, but we certainly do note the comments about, you know, the need to ensure if there is registers in different locations that proper coordination and integration is achieved. Another important comment that came across in a number of the submissions was in relation to access to the information. And it was noted that the bill does not explicitly provide for beneficial ownership registers to be made publicly available. And the bill should provide for timeous and direct access to beneficial ownership registers. And certain categories of persons should have access to beneficial ownership registers, in particular, accountable institutions and relevant authorities. And it was finally noted that the bill does not specify which information of the prescribed information will be made available to users. And so the access to the registers will be dealt with through appropriately developed regulations after consultation with all stakeholders, and it will be managed in a staged process in line with the approach by most other FATF-compliant jurisdictions. And regulations will set out the details around the access to the information that will be contained in the register, and this would be made after consultation by the relevant minister, with the Minister of Finance and the Financial Intelligence Center. So this will ensure that the development of the regulations in relation to the different registers under the different pieces of legislation are consistent and coordinated. The registers will be accessible to competent authorities and obliged entities having obligations for reporting, etc., on a tiered access basis, taking into consideration the Protection of Personal Information Act and the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And FATF, in terms of FATF requirements, the question of open access is left by FATF for countries to decide. And in our context, you know, the precise details of access to the
recording in progress.
And the FATF interpretation note to recommendation 24, it is not required that the registry remain public, but it is important that some form of access by anti-money laundering obliged persons to affect the sharing of information between designated and authorities be facilitated to affect the cross-checking of data. And it's important to note that, you know, in relation both to the, you know, the previous comment and this comment, you know, the importance of registers is, you know, to provide a basis for a foundation for the source of information to be relied upon by authorities. It isn't, you know, by itself going to sort of solve all of the issues that may arise in relation to ensuring, addressing anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing. And so the goal is to ensure timely, accurate information is available to competent authorities, accountable institutions, and that it's ensured that where appropriate, the provision of this information is compelled under legislation so that it is available and then the necessary authorities and accountable institutions can have access to the information. Another comment that came up in a number of submissions was in relation to public participation regarding the drafting of the legislation. And it was noted that there are numerous instances where the bill provides for reporting requirements, time periods, and people to whom information can be disclosed should be prescribed in regulations. And then there isn't a mention in the legislation about, there's reference to consultation with the Minister of Finance and the Financial Intelligence Center, but not in relation to, you know, public participation. So generally, we would note that draft regulations and subordinate legislation are, as a matter of routine, published for public comment before publication. And the importance of public consultation on the regulations in terms of this bill is certainly agreed. And there are already explicit requirements for public consultation in relation to all regulations made in terms of the Companies Act and the Nonprofit Organizations Act. And the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development consistently publishes all subordinate legislation for comment before promulgation, even if there might not necessarily be an explicit requirement in the primary legislation. And so the draft regulations envisaged in the legislation will certainly be published for public comment before they would be finally promulgated. And concerns have been raised regarding the capacity of the Directorate for Nonprofit Organizations and the Department of Social Development, and also noting the capacity of the CIPC and the Master's Office will they potentially have the capacity to fully implement effectively the obligations that will be imposed on them in terms of this legislation in relation to collecting and maintaining registers of information, and also in relation to the Directorate for Nonprofit Organizations, in relation to the registration of nonprofit organizations. And the capacitation concerns are certainly raised and noted, and some more detailed information will be provided. And as the role and mandate of these entities expands, a government will certainly consider and address issues to ensuring that their resources are increased as necessary through the budget processes. Another comment that was made by a few stakeholders was in relation to the provision at the end of the bill providing for the commencement of the legislation. And it was highlighted that while it is noted that the legislation is urgent and needs to be enacted, it was highlighted that accountable institutions should be afforded an appropriate time period to implement the necessary changes to risk management and compliance programs to ensure compliance with the amended legislation. And it will be important to allow for a reasonable transitional period to be provided for when the provisions amending the various pieces of legislation come into operation, as it is pertinent that the impacted entities, accountable institutions, and other entities are afforded reasonable opportunity to put in place the implementation measures and that are necessary, and to ensure that there is adequate time to implement the relevant amendments and ensure compliance. These comments are certainly noted and are taken into consideration. It is submitted that beneficial ownership obligations already exist on all accountable institutions, and they are required to perform their beneficial ownership inquiries using client access information. And beneficial ownership registry information will assist accountable institutions to verify their beneficial ownership information that they have obtained from clients. So it is anticipated that there should not be substantial additional time that would be necessary to implement any access by accountable institutions to the beneficial ownership information from the contemplated registries. The various amendments to the legislation will be brought into operation as soon as practicable once the relevant regulations are developed and have gone through a consultation process. Now, it is necessary to bring the legislation into operation immediately or, you know, very promptly, because in terms of FATF assessments, the countries are assessed based on when the legislation is actually operational and not just enacted. And so to be able to satisfy the necessary requirements, it is necessary to actually bring the legislation into force promptly and to ensure that it is being implemented. So in this particular situation, the leeway for allowing for a significant transitional period for actually bringing in the regulations into operation is somewhat more limited than might usually be the case with ordinary legislation, when we may bring provisions into operation at significantly different times, depending on the nature of the provisions and what other measures need to be in place for implementation. The regulators will assist accountable institutions to ensure that they receive the required support to be able to implement the new requirements before actual enforcement action might be taken for non-compliance with the new obligations. So there will be some period in which, you know, it will be sought to support the implementation of the measures before there would be, you know, penalties or other enforcement measures that would be taken in relation to noncompliance. And we certainly note that the requests for effective communication and engagement regarding the legislation, and that it will certainly be sought to provide for effective communication and engagement. So now we can take a look at a few of the comments on the Trust Property Control Act. And the first comment that came out in a number of commentators is that the amendments are not explicit in bringing foreign-owned trusts within the disclosure framework, and there is no clear indication that the bill will also apply to foreign trusts and entities. And we certainly note that the foreign trust, trust property must be, even by foreign trust, must be brought within the ambit of the beneficial ownership provisions, even if it is administered in terms of a foreign trust, and consideration will be given possibly to ensuring that the provisions are more explicit in relation to the approach in relation to foreign trust. We would, however, submit that, in fact, the legislation certainly does already apply to foreign-owned trusts, the Trust Property Control Act as a whole, and it is also a bit of an unfortunate naming convention, as a trust is not, in fact, owned. So using the term foreign-owned trust is not really sort of an accurate term, but it is important to note, in terms of Section 8 of the Act, as it currently provides, a trustee of a foreign trust who has to administer trust property in South Africa is included, and a non-resident person based outside of South Africa appointed as a trustee to administer trust property in South Africa is included. And so it follows that a trust that is formed outside of South Africa or that is formed by persons who are not South African residents would nonetheless be regulated by the Trust Property Control Act if the trust property is located in South Africa. But we certainly do note the comments and quite likely, there may be some refinements proposed to ensure that the situation is explicitly clarified. In relation to comments on disqualifications of trustees, there were a number of technical drafting comments that were submitted, and we certainly appreciate those, and we will certainly consider those very carefully and include appropriate refinements in light of those comments. In relation to the removal of a trustee, it was noted that if the trustee's estate is sequestrated or liquidated or placed under judicial management, in relation to that phrasing, in order to prevent any uncertainty, there was some wording proposed to be included in relation to that provision. And we would note that the new Section 6.1a lists an unrehabilitated insolvent as a reason for disqualification to act as a trustee, and so they therefore could be removed under Section 20. But it will be considered to provide for that it's ensured that there's an appropriate linkage made between Section 6.1a and Section 20 of the Act as it is proposed to be amended by Clause 7. Next, we will consider some of the comments on the Nonprofit Organizations Act. These amendments attracted a substantial proportion of the comments on the bill. And it was first submitted that the bill does not necessarily address the FATF requirements under Recommendation 8. And it's noted that the primary concerns of the FATF were that South Africa has not yet done an assessment of their broader NPO sector to identify those organizations based on their characteristics or activities which do not put them at risk of terrorism financing abuse. And secondly, it was highlighted that South Africa does not have capacity to monitor or investigate nonprofit organizations to be identified to be at risk of terrorism financing abuse. And it is further submitted that recommendation 8 does not apply to the NPO sector as a whole. Countries should take a targeted approach to implementing the measures called for in recommendation 8, including oversight and regulatory mechanisms based on an understanding of the diversity of the NPO sector and the terrorism risks faced by the domestic NPO sector. Given the variety of legal forms the nonprofit organizations can have, depending on the country, the FATF has adopted a functional definition of NPO activity. And this definition is based on those whose activities and characteristics put them at risk of terrorist financing abuse, rather than on the simple fact that it is operating on a nonprofit basis. And it's finally submitted that recommendation only applies to those NPOs which fall under the FATF definition of nonprofit organization. And so this, you know, these submissions were certainly given a very careful consideration, and it's highlighted that a nonprofit organization is a legal person or arrangement or organization that primarily engages in raising or dispersing funds for purposes as charitable, religious, cultural, educational, social, or fraternal purposes, or for the carrying out of other types of good works. Recommendation 8 provides that not all nonprofit organizations are inherently high risk, and some may represent low or no risk, and so it is required to identify which subset of organizations fall within the FATF definition of nonprofit organization and use all relevant sources of information in order to identify the features and types of nonprofit organizations which, by virtue of all their activities or characteristics, are likely to be at risk of terrorist financing abuse. It's also required to identify the nature of threats posed by terrorist activities to the nonprofit organizations which are at risk, as well as how terrorist actors abuse those nonprofit organizations. It's further highlighted that it's necessary to review the adequacy of those measures, including laws and regulations that relate to the subset of the nonprofit organizations sector that may be abused for terrorism financing support, in order to be able to take proportionate and effective actions to address the risks identified. Countries should take steps to promote effective supervision or monitoring such that they are able to demonstrate that risk-based measures apply to nonprofit organizations at risk of terrorism financing abuse. And authorities must monitor the compliance of nonprofit organizations, including the risk-based measures, and authorities must be able to apply effective, proportionate, and dissuasive sanctions for violations by nonprofit organizations acting on behalf of the nonprofit organization. So this sets out the requirements under Recommendation 8, and these requirements will inform the proposed approach that we will go into in significantly further later in this presentation in relation to nonprofit organizations. Another key submission that was made by the nonprofit organization sector in their submissions was that the majority of commentators do not support the provisions of the bill requiring compulsory registration of all NPOs, citing constitutionality issues, especially as they may affect religious organizations. And it was also argued that the requirement for compulsory registration would go beyond what FATF requirements actually stipulate. And it was highlighted, you know, concerns about the capacity of the Department of Social Development to implement the bill and the administrative burden on smaller NGOs, particularly religious organizations, was highlighted. And it was also proposed that sections 12, 3, and 30 of the NPO Act should be amended to specify that the Department of Social Development cannot require changes to religious companies, religious organizations' founding documents that would interfere with the religious organization's doctrines, tenets, and beliefs. And two, it was also submitted that the threat of imprisonment or a limitless fine in the event of noncompliance should also be removed. And in light of the submissions on the compulsory registration aspect in particular, and having considered their submissions and proposals, the National Treasury will present to the committee detailed proposals to adjust the initially proposed blanket registration requirement for NPOs, which will focus on the registration of a limited subset of NPOs, those which make donations or provide services beyond South Africa's borders, where they could potentially be used intentionally or unintentionally in the financing of terrorism. And we'll go into this in more detail later in the presentation. Regarding the capacity of the directorate to implement mandatory registration, the directorate is engaging, regarding potential capacitation and staffing to respond to the demands that will arise in relation to the functions that it will be undertaking in terms of the bill. And it is noted that in relation to registration, the legislated turnaround time for registration in 2 months, and however, the NPO Directorate will undertake a review of NPO client services operations in order to develop a sustainable strategy for meeting its service standards and reducing registration turnaround time significantly. Another comment that was made by commentators was that there hasn't been a risk assessment undertaken of the NPO sector to identify those organizations at risk prior to the drafting of those amendments. And it was submitted that without understanding the nature and the threat of terrorism financing to NPOs and the subset of NPOs which are particularly vulnerable, it is irresponsible to implement measures which purport to respond to those vulnerabilities. And it was submitted that the proposed amendments and the potential consequences for South Africa's NPO sector are disproportionate to the minimal risk identified. The National Terrorist Financing Risk Assessment was conducted by the Interdepartmental Working Group, which is a multi-agency government-led process involving the private sector, and it identified terrorist financing vulnerabilities, threats, and risks. And the finding is that the South African-based NPOs and their charities are vulnerable to potential abuse by terrorist financing terrorist groups, despite the fact that the sector is not currently assessed as posing a significant terrorist financing risk. Although there have not been terrorism financing convictions that have arisen in the South African NPO sector to date, the prevalence of cash and specifically charities operating near or in conflict zones associated with terrorism pose a higher terrorism financing risk. And those charities and NPOs or individuals within the charities and NPOs are at risk of being exploited by terrorist financing terrorist groups in these areas. And there is a further technical team process, with an aim to gain a further understanding of the risk in the NPO sector. And the findings of that technical team will also assist to strengthen the NPO risk assessment. A further comment was in relation to, it was queried whether domestic or foreign NPOs should be subject to the same process and standards. And it is submitted that any NPO that raises money in South Africa and disperses it in other countries should be registered, irrespective of whether they are legally domiciled in South Africa or not. And so the application to foreign NPOs will be streamlined with the proposed registration requirements. Another comment was in relation to Clause 11, relating to the provision of reports and information. And there is currently no obligation specified that the prescribed information that's required in terms of that section must be kept up to date and accurate. And this comment is noted, and certainly consideration will be given to adding a provision to provide for an explicit requirement in that regard. Another comment was in relation to amending the proposed to amend the definition of office bearer. And directors of nonprofit organizations and trustees are those who are responsible for governance, who sit on the governing board or body of the entity, and who have ultimate fiduciary responsibility for the organization. In voluntary associations, it was noted that those who govern have ultimate fiduciary responsibility are elected by members to serve on the committee governing body. And so the references in the current definition to executive position is to those who manage and administer the trust or nonprofit organization, so it's proposed that it should be corrected to ensure that the same functional group or status is being referred to and is relatively consistent across the types of legal entities and the various pieces of legislation. And so if the amendment would be made, then it would not be necessary to disclose details of the board of a voluntary association, but those of their CEO and senior managerial staff. This comment will be further noted and given careful consideration. And if the scope of NPOs that are required to be registered is significantly reduced, as is proposed in our presentation, the concern in relation to the scope of application of the definition of office bearer would be significantly reduced potentially, or might even fall away. Other comments were made in relation to the provision relating to the disqualification and removal of office bearers. Some amendments were proposed to subsection 11, and then also it was highlighted that there is no apparent link between these new requirements to be or continue to act as an office bearer of an NPO on the one hand, and the objective of combating terrorism financing. And it was noted that, for example, if someone becomes insolvent, that does not suggest an openness to terrorism financing. And it must also be stressed that many NPOs, especially small ones that grow organically from within communities, do not handle large amounts of money. And so the office bearer criteria that may apply to public companies or trusts, for example, would not necessarily be appropriately applicable to NPOs. And thirdly, it was noted that the criteria for disqualification of an unemancipated minor or someone under legal disability, it was proposed that requirement should be removed. In respect of part of the proposal, it is not supported as a trustee and an office bearer at an NGO are not necessarily comparable. And so other safeguards are put in place to deal with this difference in the type of position, which is particularly in paragraphs E, 2, and 3. And it should also be borne in mind that the definition of office bearer in the NPO Act, and so it is in fact unlikely that a minor will hold this position, and so we will certainly give consideration to the reference to an unemancipated minor. We do know, however, that we did largely try to align the provisions with some of the disqualification provisions in the Companies Act, as it was determined. You know that generally a lot of the provisions in Section 69 of the Companies Act are quite appropriate and helpful in relation to defining the scope of persons who should be disqualified from acting as office bearers of nonprofit organizations. And then it was finally noted that the new offenses provided by the bill have the potential to deter persons from acting as office bearers of nonprofit organizations, and the blanket criminalization of the obligations may have unintended consequences, and consideration should be given to whether the contraventions should be penalized rather by administrative sanctions rather than criminal sanctions. And it was also highlighted that the effect of the bill would be to send religious leaders to jail for failing to adhere to administrative requirements. And the amendments were made without sufficient public awareness being raised, and religious leaders were therefore unaware of the bill and the effect that it will have on them and their religious organizations. The comments regarding the offenses is certainly noted, and further consideration will be given as to the appropriate penalty that should be imposed in relation to the contraventions of the legislation. And if the scope of NPOs that are required to be registered, you know, the potential scope of impact of offenses also would be significantly reduced. And then we would note a few provisions, comments relating to the Financial Intelligence Center Act. And the first couple are in relation to a couple of definitions in the Act, amendments to the definitions. And the first is in relation to the definition of investigative division in a national department. And it was noted that the substitution of the term organ of state with the term national department introduces a far narrower definition and excludes certain critical functionaries from being able to participate in critical information sharing. It is noted in this regard that the ability of the FIC to share intelligence information that it holds is set out in Section 40 of the FIC Act, and the agencies are specified and include all law enforcement agencies, SARS, IPED, the Public Protector, the National Prosecuting Authority, and intelligence services. And so the proposed amendment is to one item on this list, which is an investigative division in an organ of state. So it's submitted that the amendment, in fact, shouldn't have a significant impact on the ability for sharing of information. Another comment was in relation to the definition of proliferation financing, and it was proposed that the definition should be more closely aligned with the FATF definition. In this regard, it's noted that a distinction must be made between the concept of weapons of mass destruction proliferation and financing of proliferation. In respect of compliance obligations in respect of proliferation financing, the FIC Act provisions are aimed at dealing with targeted financial sanctions, which includes targeted federal sanctions relating to the risk of proliferation, financing of proliferation. Compliance obligations also extend to identifying the risk of proliferation financing. The commentators' proposals are proposing incorporating elements of weapons of mass destruction proliferation. And in addition, the proposed definition of the bill is adapted to take into account terminology that is otherwise used in the Financial Intelligence Center Act. Another comment that was made is that it was proposed that the amendment in Clause 17 should expressly provide for greater transparency and accountability, both to the Minister of Finance and to the wider public. And this could be done in the form of the minister presenting an annual report before the relevant portfolio committee in Parliament and the report itself being made publicly accessible. It was also noted that the challenge with suspicious transaction reports is that there is no way of knowing whether accountable institutions are in fact reporting suspicious activities, and nor is there any way of tracking, whether the Financial Intelligence Center is in fact acting upon the suspicious transaction reports that it receives. In response to these proposals, it's noted that the FIC is a public entity that's listed in Schedule 3 of the PFMA, and therefore is bound by the prescripts of that act. And so already the FIC's annual report, which includes information relating to the work performed by the FIC annually, is publicly made available to and tabled in Parliament. And the FIC's annual report contains statistics relating to the number of suspicious transaction reports received, as well as reports disseminated by the FIC to agencies entitled to receive the reports. And the FIC Act provides that the FIC must annually review and submit a report to the Minister of Finance annually on the implementation of the FIC Act as required by Section 4E of the FIC Act. And the FIC does this each year when it submits a separate implementation report. And the FIC Act provides that the report be made available to the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Finance then may decide whether to make or release that report or parts of the report to the public. Another comment was in relation to ongoing due diligence in Clause 20, and it was noted that the proposed amendment enables the accountable institution to abandon its ongoing due diligence efforts if such due diligence was off the client, if due diligence was initiated on the back of a Section 29 report. And so it was submitted that there is an incongruency between this clause and Clause 21, as in one instance you may forfeit the refresh, but in another similar situation the refresh is enforced. The proposed wording provides for instances where the accountable institution suspects a transaction or activity is suspicious in terms of Section 29, and the institution reasonably believes that performing the customer due diligence measures in terms of Section 21C will disclose to the client that a suspicious transaction report will be made to the Financial Intelligence Center, and in that case, it may discontinue the customer due diligence process and consider filing a suspicious transaction report. The use of the term may indicate that the provision may be used if such circumstances arise and is not required in all instances. This requirement is one of the deficiencies identified by FATF that the FIC Act does not address meet the requirement in Recommendation 10 that where an accountable institution is unable to comply with a relevant customer due diligence measure, it should be required to consider making a suspicious transaction report in relation to its client. And Clause 21 is dealt with in the next comments below. Another comment in relation to Clause 21 was about doubts about the veracity of previously obtained information when reporting suspicious and unusual transactions. And it was highlighted that there is a concern for tipping off when the submission of a suspicious or unusual transaction report coincides with the process of ongoing due diligence, as is evidenced by the addition of subsection 2 to subsection 21C in clause 20 of the bill. The proposed amendment of section 21D also creates a risk of tipping off if an accountable institution is required to repeat customer due diligence requirements when a section 29 report is made. It was noted that the insertion of the word or and the content of section 21D paragraph B, the resultant effect is that each time an accountable institution submits a suspicious transaction or unusual transaction report in terms of section 29, the steps contemplated in sections 21 and 21B are to be performed. And in the absence of the provision contemplating a suspicious transaction report being filed based on adequacy, veracity of the information, the obligation it is submitted is too onerous and unnecessary. And it is, in response, it is highlighted that the context of the proposals in the bill are different in Clause 20, and the same wording cannot be applied in relation to Clause 21. The context of the wording in Clause 21 stems from a deficiency identified in Recommendation 10 that the FIC Act does not provide for customer due diligence measures to be undertaken when there is suspicion of money laundering or terrorism financing. Clause 21 requires an accountable institution when, after entering into a single transaction or establishing a business relationship, makes a suspicious transaction report. It must repeat the customer due diligence measures referred to in Section 21 and 21B to the extent that it is necessary to confirm the information previously obtained. The extent to which the accountable institution conducts this exercise will depend on the risk as set out in its risk management compliance policy. The essential difference in Clause 20 and 21 is that in Clause 20, the suspicious transaction report has not been made, while in Clause 21, the requirement is in instances where a suspicious transaction report has been submitted to the Financial Intelligence Center. The use of the word or indicates that the issue of veracity of previously obtained information is not linked to the requirement when a suspicious transaction report is made. They are two separate issues. Another comment was relating to the notification of persons and entities identified by the UN Security Council. And in terms of the Kopitar Amendment Bill, it's noted that Section 25 will be repealed and is replaced by a reference to Section 26A of the FIC Act. And it is therefore proposed that the repeal be preempted in this bill and that Section 26A2 be deleted. And it was submitted that considering the proposed amendments to Section 26A1 and 26B1, the notice referred to will become superfluous and suggest that Section 26A3 be, it is suggested that 26A3 be deleted. And finally, it was submitted that a resolution adopted by the UN Security Council as contemplated in Section 26A1 of the FIC Act has immediate effect. It is proposed that the director of the FIC must give immediate notice of the adoption. In response, it's noted that the proposed amendments to the FIC Act have been included in the Pakatara Amendment Bill currently before the Police Portfolio Committee. And the amendment bill contains amendments to the FIC Act that delete Section 26A2, which will bring the targeted financial sanction regime relating to terrorism into the scope of the FIC Act. All consequential amendments as a result of this are being dealt with through the amendments to the Pakhtunkhwa Amendment Bill. And the Pakhtunkhwa Amendment Bill was at an advanced stage in its development and processing when the proposals to amend the FIC Act in this General Laws Amendment Bill were developed. And in light of this, it was determined that it would be appropriate to keep the amendments as they were in the FIC Act and the Pakhtunkhwa Amendment Bill, and the timing of the bills are being monitored, and it is being coordinated in the process in the Police Portfolio Committee that potential amendments will be submitted in that committee process to align the relevant provisions in the two pieces of legislation. Finally, it's noted that the insertion of the word immediate is not supported, as the removal of the wording from time to time is a safeguard that the notice will be published as soon as practicable. Then there was a submission on Clause 30 of the bill relating to intervention by the FIC, and there was a proposal to refine the wording. And we would submit, in light of possible consequences of the proposed amendment in Clause 30 that have been identified, that it is proposed that that this amendment in the bill would be withdrawn. Then there were comments relating to the protection of personal information, and it was highlighted that the proposed provision merely reiterates what's provided in Section 6 of the Protection of Personal Information Act regarding the processing of personal information being excluded if the public body is acting as the agent and as per the instruction of the public body. And it was noted this would therefore require the FIC to instruct an accountable institution as its agent to process the specific personal information to be able to apply the exclusion of the POPI Act. And based on our understanding, it would not be enable the information sharing among accountable institutions to detect, prevent, and report financial crime and money laundering activity. And these comments are noted, and further consideration will be given to a potential proposal for revision of the section. Other comments related to risk management and compliance in relation to Clause 36, and it was proposed that Section 42(2)(q)(4) should be amended in order to cater for the absence, where there is an absence of risk, and it was proposed to delete references to branches and subsidiaries. In response, it submitted that there will not be an instance where there would be no risk whatsoever if the host country does not have equivalent AML-CFT measures as contained in the FIC Act, and so it is not supported to that it's necessary to cater for the circumstances where there is an absence of risk. And the second proposal is not supported, as the amendments are intended to address the deficiencies raised in the mutual evaluation report that accountable institutions should be required to implement group-wide programs to all branches and majority-owned subsidiaries of the accountable institution. Then there are comments relating to penalties and sanctions, and it was noted that in the FIC Act in Section 45C, a fine is capped of 10 million rand for natural persons and 50 million rand for legal entities. And however, having set fines without consideration of a natural person's net worth or a company's turnover may result in little or no impact if the person is particularly rich or a company particularly large. So it was proposed that the the caps on fines and on penalties needs to be revised to take into account net worth or turnover. And it was noted that the amendment proposed in Clause 39 to Section 52 of the Act detrimentally impacts the practice of journalism. And the inclusion of any other person could include a journalist reporting on issues relevant to the FIC, and so creates an offense for a journalist to fail to report prescribed information to the FIC. This creates an ethical conflict and would severely hamper the ability of journalists to investigate and report on instances of financial crime. Excuse me. It's noted that over and above the financial penalties, there are other administrative penalties, such as business activities or suspension. And also the penalties are set per offense. So if there are a number of contraventions, the penalties will be commensurate with the number of contraventions. It is noted that also that when there's a cap, you know, that would mean that the, you know, generally in each case, the circumstances of the particular case would be considered, and so that and an appropriate fine would be determined, taking into account a matter such as, you know, the overall net worth of a person or a company's turnover. It is recognized, you know, that you know, caps do from time to time potentially need to be reviewed to ensure that they remain appropriate in the context of inflation. And so it is noted generally in relation to legislation that you know, that comment is noted. But in this instance, it is not felt that the cap should be increased, you know, above the current proposed threshold of 10 million rand. Any other person in the context of the FIC Act refers to persons who have an obligation to report a suspicious transaction. And in terms of Section 29, a person who carries on a business, is in charge of a business, manages or is employed in the business, and suspects that the business has received or is about to receive the process of unlawful activities or other transactions set out in this section, is obliged to report the suspicion to the FIC. And it is submitted that the scenario highlighted by the commentators in relation to journalists will not apply, as it would only apply if the business they were employed by is actually involved in any of the activities set out in Section 29. So it should not apply to the you know, the journalistic activities of investigation of matters relating to financial crime. Then we move on to a few of the comments on the Companies Act. The first comments were in relation to nominee ownership, and the bill's approach to nominee arrangements is proposed to be seriously considered. And it was highlighted that state capture was enabled through the use of nominee arrangements. And with the country still reeling in the aftermath of state capture, it is not clear what the intention of preserving these arrangements is. And clearer consideration for the treatment of nominee ownership arrangements would be beneficial. So generally, we certainly understand and appreciate, you know, these comments, and I think, you know, generally it is supported to appropriately ensure that the nominee arrangements are appropriately provided for in the legislation, and this is dealt with in a bit more detail in the detailed responses matrix. But you know, there would need to be a bit more engagement and regarding, you know, how to appropriately fully address an appropriate approach to nominee arrangements. And so it is submitted that quite likely it would be appropriate to address these matters through the forthcoming Companies Amendment Bill process. Other significant comments were made in relation to beneficial ownership information in that would be required to be provided in respect of publicly listed companies, and provision to empower the minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance and the Financial Intelligence Center to, it was proposed that it should be empowered to exempt certain companies, including listed companies, from the requirement to file a record of the natural persons who ultimately own or control the company and any changes. And concerns were raised about the practical implications of the requirement, especially for listed companies with large registers, which may consist of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of shareholders. There were some queries about whether CIPC systems would be able to cater for such large securities registers. And also, there was some question of the value of providing for such requirements, as the annual register would only show who shareholders are at a particular point in time. And for active listed companies, the shareholding continually changes. So, the ability of the shareholders' registers to provide for promoting transparency may be somewhat limited. So we've certainly carefully considered these submissions and further consideration is being given to them. And we will touch on this a bit further later in this presentation, and some detailed proposals will be presented to the committee to potentially address some of these concerns. Another comment was provided about proposed additions to Section 8 of the Companies Act to provide for the registration of nonprofit companies where a voluntary association primarily receives or makes donations and has its PI score go over a threshold level at which an audit might become compulsory for a nonprofit company. And, this would require some measures to be undertaken by the CIPC, to have a process for conversion and in place. And then otherwise, SARS may also have to implement some measures to continue tax reference numbers, et cetera, and other information if a conversion was undertaken, and banking and accounting history in relation to entities would need to continue. These comments are noted and will certainly be a consideration too. And it would require some consideration by the DTIC, the CIPC and SARS as to how these sorts of matters might be appropriately addressed. And as it does not necessarily relate to an existing provision in the bill, it's quite likely that this type of, appropriate measures might be considered in the forthcoming Companies Amendment Bill process. Then there was a proposed amendment to Section 52, subsection 2. That it was recommended that, access should be given for the public to inspect company securities registers, and that there should also be the proactive publication of this data, and this would make disclosure mandatory and ensure that disclosure would not be prohibited by the Protection of Personal Information Act, and it would relieve companies of the administrative burden of fielding direct requests under Section 26 of the Companies Act. And it would also enhance and broaden the understanding and scope of ownership and for better cross-checks of who owns listed companies. And in response, this comment is noted and will be given some further consideration, although as this proposal would require a new amendment to be added to the current bill, it is likely an aspect that does require some careful consideration in light of the further information provision requirements in the Companies Act. And, it may be quite appropriate if appropriate measures would be would be proposed to amend the Companies Act, that this would be undertaken during the Companies Amendment Bill process by the DITC. Then there were comments on the annual returns provisions in Clause 33, and it was recommended that an obligation should be placed on nonprofit companies to disclose if members register in their annual return, and as they are somewhat analogous to beneficial owners for a nonprofit, in a for-profit company, and this would require some refinements to the existing provisions. And the existing Section 50 only relates to company securities registers, and Section 24.4 of the Companies Act refers to both securities registers and members registers. It's also noted that Section 33 also addresses external companies and their obligation to file an annual return. And however, this section does not subject external companies to the beneficial ownership regime, and this is of concern. And so it is noted that Section 33.2 of the Companies Act addresses external or foreign companies and their obligation to file an annual return. However, the amendments proposed in the General Laws Amendment Bill do not seem to subject external companies to the beneficial ownership regime. And so in response, it is in agreement to submit nonprofit companies registers for filing their annual returns. And also, it is in agreement to submit external companies to this requirement. And it will be further considered, however, whether these refinements should be included in this bill or quite possibly in the forthcoming Companies Amendment Bill. And in relation to access to information, it's highlighted that the current Companies Act provides for making information kept in companies registry available to the public. This is in terms of Section 187.4C, and this will make the submitted beneficial ownership information subject to this provision. But however, this will be done in line with the protection of privacy as envisaged in the POPIA Act, and the same principle will be applied in relation to the current disclosures of information that the CIPC makes in terms of Section 187. And so the details regarding access to information in the registers will be set out in forthcoming regulations, as has been previously noted. Then finally, there's comments on the requirement to file prescribed benefit ownership information with the CIPC. Some commentators propose that there should in fact be a separate Section 56A inserted in the Companies Act to provide for the beneficial ownership information rather than including it in Section 56. It was also noted that there is no provision for the disclosure of the information. And it was also noted, queried whether a requirement to include beneficial ownership information in both the securities register and in the separate beneficial ownership register would be an unnecessary duplication. There was concern about practical difficulties and administrative burdens for listed companies in particular to comply with requirements. And then exemption consideration for providing an exemption was proposed. And clarification was requested regarding the relationship between beneficial ownership and beneficial interest, and whether there would be two distinct reports that must be submitted. And it is proposed to place an obligation on the holders of beneficial interests and beneficial owners to report their interest to ensure that reporting is accurate and complete. And these comments are noted, and careful further consideration will be given to them. And so requirements regarding the disclosure of information will be set out in regulations, and comments relating to whom access to information must be ensured will be considered in order to ensure that the disclosure of information is appropriately addressed in the promulgated regulations. It will be further considered if some further specification regarding access should be provided in the primary provision, but generally it's thought to be appropriate that these details should be completely set out in the regulations. The comments regarding the potential duplication of reporting of information and practical difficulties and administrative burdens on listed companies are noted, and comments regarding the distinction and relationship between beneficial ownership and beneficial interest and the reporting of beneficial interest and beneficial ownership information are certainly noted and will be further considered, and appropriate refinements will be submitted to the committee in light of the further consideration of these comments, particularly the aspect of the of reporting requirements based on listed companies, and also the proposal that an obligation should potentially be imposed on the holders of beneficial interests and beneficial owners to report their interests where there may be alternative and reliable sources of information available regarding beneficial owners. It must ultimately be ensured, however, that beneficial ownership information is collected and ultimately made available to the competent authorities and law enforcement agencies. And the current criteria for beneficial interest holders does not meet the FATF definition of beneficial ownership. And therefore, whatever mechanism is ultimately implemented for collecting information, it must be ensured that the collected beneficial ownership information is in accordance with the FATF requirements. And it is important to note that Section 56 does not apply to all entities, and the disclosures in terms of the section are subject to the entity meeting the requirement criteria of a regulated company defined in Section 117, subsection 1I. And so this means that the entity should be engaging in affected transaction or if the takeover regulations apply to it. Then finally, there were a couple of comments on the Financial Sector Regulation Act amendments. The first was that the definition of beneficial owner that's included could be expanded to give further clarity on reporting obligations by defining the circumstances under which owners or controls may apply, and some alternative proposed wording of the definition of beneficial ownership was proposed by some commentators. And certainly it was proposed that wherever the definition of natural person appears in the definition, it should be amended to state natural persons. So the submissions that were made are being given consideration, and proposed refinements to the bill to the definition of beneficial ownership will be presented to the committee. It is noted that quite possibly, the requirements relating to the obligations when, there may need to be reporting by beneficial owners would be addressed appropriately through conduct standards that would be issued, which my understanding is what would be envisaged under the proposed approach. And then finally, there was a comment in Clause 59 relating to the power to make standards, and it was noted that there might potentially be some confusion between requirements that would be applicable to significant owners and beneficial owners, who are distinct categories of persons, and cognizance of that should be taken in to avoid unintended consequences. And then it was also clarity was also sought about what fit and proper requirements would be constituted in relation to beneficial ownership. And while Section 69 of the Companies Act provides for ineligibility and disqualifications of persons, there is no law that dictates the ineligibility of persons entitled to purchase shares or hold ownership of companies. and it's unclear on what basis the shared standard is being sought in the absence of legislation relating to the criterion for a person to hold an ownership interest. These comments are noted and will be further considered in relation to the development of standards that will be made, and it will be sought to ensure that there is clear distinction between requirements applicable to significant owners and beneficial owners. Certainly the comment relating to fit and proper requirements and, you know, whether it would be appropriate to be considering fit and proper requirements in relation to beneficial owners, you know, it will be considered, and, you know, potentially, you know, providing for fit and proper requirements would not be a matter that would be addressed with in conduct standards per se. It would be more focusing on setting out, you know, how beneficial ownership would be implemented in particular circumstances and the obligations of beneficial owners. And then finally, there was a comment in relation to directives in relation to beneficial owners. And it was noted that the section doesn't impose a sanction to encourage adherence. And so it was suggested maybe including a reference to the new Section 159C in the offenses section under the FSR Act. Now, even a contravention of Section 159C would enable various enforcement measures to be undertaken in relation to a contravention, and also administrative penalties to be imposed in relation to a contravention. And it will be further considered if, you know, it would be desired to actually make a contravention of such a directive to be an offense under the Financial Sector Regulation Act. There will certainly be the potential for certain measures and administrative penalties to be imposed under the Act. And then there was a proposed insertion by BASA to include a new Section 159C to impose a specific duty on beneficial owners to provide information. And this will be given further consideration also. But it will be considered in light of whether it would be appropriate to provide for that in the primary legislation or potentially in standards that would be issued. So that concludes our summary of the and responses to some of the key comments. Now, Okide will take us through the proposed approach to registration of a nonprofit organization.
Thank you, Janine. And I will maybe just make a few contextual comments, Janine, and then ask you maybe to take over. Apologies, I'm being loaded and I've been told I have about 4 minutes left on my battery, so apologies for that. But Che, what we'll now do is sort of is drill in onto some of the proposals in relation to the MPOs that had largely come out of the engagements that we'd had with the sector. Chair, what you'll see in the specific proposals is that we really sought to take on board some of their principal concerns, including a narrowing of the universe of MPOs that will be subject to the clauses to make sure that we don't, you know, catch knitting clubs, and I think there was a specific example proposed, and really have the lens applied on those NPOs whose risks require a level of supervision for AML-CFT purposes because of the nature of the activities that are undertaken. That's not to say that everyone who undertakes these activities is a bad actor. Quite the opposite. We believe that the vast majority of MPOs operating in this space are good actors, but some level of oversight and information is required to ensure that those that can be used for the financing of terrorism are adequately and identified and those activities prevented. You'll also note that there will be some comments around the capacitation, which we took on board and noted, and really looking to ensure that we don't impose an unworkable bureaucracy for the NPOs under this section, and to make sure that they are that as far as possible there's adequate capacity to ensure that that the administrative burden is minimized on them. So Janine, if you could just sort of take us through the next sort of couple of slides, and then I understand the FIC will come in office. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So in light of all of the comments that were submitted so far in relation to the proposed mandatory registration of all NPOs, we are giving very careful consideration to developing draft refinements to present to the committee, and we'll be giving still some further thought to the approach and the specifics of the provisions that would be refinements that will be proposed to the committees. At this stage, we would like to give a sense of what our proposed approach would be in taking into consideration all of the comments and the necessity to sort of balance the implications of registration on NPOs, but also the need to ensure compliance with the requirements of Recommendation 8 of the FATF recommendations. And so the sort of outline of what we would propose that would be that not all nonprofit organizations would be required to register, so there wouldn't be a blanket registration requirement. Only a subset of NPOs would be proposed to be required to register, and these would particularly focus on any NPO that makes donations to individuals or organizations domiciled in a foreign country, including when such individuals are physically in South Africa, and also any NPO that provides humanitarian, charitable, religious, educational, or cultural services outside of South Africa's borders. And we really have undertaken some analysis to try to focus on, you know, the specific types of NPOs where really there is a meaningful risk of misuse for terrorism financing activities. And it's proposed that this subset, focusing on this subset of nonprofit organizations, would appropriately delimit the scope of registration to where there is a significant potential for terrorism financing misuse, and would better delineate the scope of the application of the registration requirement. We would also propose to include wording in the bill or in the legislation to make it explicitly clear that the directorate does not have the discretion to refuse registration of a nonprofit organization if the requirements of the Act are complied with, in order to ensure that the registration would not be able to be exercised in a manner that would potentially infringe on the rights of freedom of association and freedom of a religion. Now, currently, that is arguably already the case in the legislation, as Section 13, Subsection 2 of the NPO Act provides that if the applicant for registration complies with the requirements of the Act, then it must be registered. However, in light of the comments received and the concerns raised, we would propose, you know, to really make that more explicit in the legislation. Similarly, wording would be proposed to ensure that the grounds on which a nonprofit organization could be deregistered could only be exercised in respect of noncompliance with requirements in the Act and would not be able to be exercised in a manner that would potentially infringe on especially constitutional rights of freedom of association and freedom of religion. Currently, the grounds for cancellation, as set out in Section 20, are non-compliance with the requirements of the Act or non-compliance with a provision of its constitution, which has not been rectified after a receipt of a notice contemplated in that section. So currently, arguably, the directorate does not have, a scope to deregister a nonprofit organization on the basis of its activities or its its funding organization. It's only in relation to the compliance with the provisions of the legislation. But again, in order to noting the concerns that have been raised in respect of the potential concerns for potential abuse of powers of registration and deregistration, it is proposed to make that more explicit in the legislation. And it's noted that in relation to the constitution of a nonprofit organization, the directorate is only able to review the constitution to ensure that it addresses the matters that are specified in Section 12.2. So it just needs to check, does the constitution actually provide for those matters? And if it does, then the constitution is compliant. And then that's the extent to which the directorate is empowered to assess the constitution. However, in light of the comments that have been received, consideration will be given to potentially make it explicit that the directorate cannot require an NPO to change its constitution, particularly in relation to its stated activities, and particularly in a manner that might potentially infringe the rights to religious freedom and freedom of association. It might only refuse registration if the Constitution does not address matters required in Section 12, Subsection 2, although arguably that really is currently the only basis on which registration could be refused in terms of the legislation. But we certainly note the comments and concerns that were made in that regard. And it is noted that making donations or provisions of services, the activities for registration is required without being deregistered would be subject to a penalty. It is necessary that there would be some penalty resulting in relation to non-compliance in order to satisfy the TATF requirements, but whether it would be criminalized is a matter that will certainly be given further consideration. And it's also emphasized that the activities of the nonprofit organizations must also be lawful and must therefore be in compliance with the provisions of the prohibition of mercenary activities and regulation of certain activities in Country of Armed Conflict Act of 2006, which includes provisions relating to providing humanitarian aid in countries that are deemed to be in conflict. And it is submitted that retaining a completely voluntary approach, as motivated by a number of commentators, would not be sufficient to satisfy compliance with recommendation 8 of the mutual evaluation report, and even having simply a notification requirement without some obligations and implications for noncompliance would also not be sufficient. It is sought to define the scope of NPOs that would be required to register to only include those that most clearly pose a risk to anti-money laundering and combating terrorism financing. And other NPOs would continue to be able to register voluntarily. And it is hoped that by narrowing the scope of some NPOs who must register, that some of the other concerns and comments may potentially be reduced or fall away, because governance requirements for those NPOs that are required to register should be reasonably rigorous. Further consideration will be given to the submissions that have been provided to the committee and subsequent submissions that will be received during the remainder of the comment process, and we will propose amendments to the bill in the, to the committee in relation to the registration of NPOs and detailed proposed refinements to the bill. Noting, it certainly was noted in the submissions, the need to ensure capacity to enable, you know, that the director for NPOs has the capacity to manage registers of beneficial owners. And more generally, it was noted that there needs to be capacitation of the various entities that will be maintaining registers in terms of the legislation, that they need to be appropriately capacitated in terms of the legislation so that they can fulfill their mandates and ensure that, in fact, the FATF requirements are ultimately complied with in practice. So currently, we do not necessarily have a clear estimate of the additional resource requirements of agencies, including the Directorate for Nonprofit Organizations, whose mandate is changed or expanded by this legislation. There will inevitably be increases in requirements for additional resources from those relevant entities and departments. And through the budget process, government will work with those departments and entities, you know, to ensure adequate resourcing of these priority functions. Then we just wanted to touch on the comments in relation to beneficial owners and the definitions in the various pieces of legislation. And we will be developing refinements to the definitions in light of very helpful comments in relation to the current provisions as they are included in the bill. And the suggestion to remove cross-referencing in the definitions of other legislation to the definition of the Financial Intelligence Center Act will be implemented, and other refinements to the definitions to ensure that the definitions capture the appropriate scope of natural persons relevant to the particular legislation will be proposed, and the submissions that have been made will be very helpful to ensure that we are able to finalize the proposed refinements to the definitions appropriately. Now I would just like to call upon Christopher Milan from the FIC just to take us through a couple of slides giving a bit more detail on the beneficial ownership information registry framework that is important work that's currently being undertaken that is relevant for the implementation of this legislation. Thank you very much, Christopher.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, colleagues and those present. Thank you for the opportunity. The concept of beneficial ownership and the South African government response to it has a long history. It goes back, and I think it's important to put this and make it clear that we have been involved as a government with the concept of the need for a beneficial ownership transparency framework. Way back, 2014, in fact, we adopted the Sydney high-level principles on beneficial ownership transparency. That was followed up by a commitment by our government to be part of the Open Government Partnership. And we, of late, we filed our fourth National Action Plan as South Africa to meet certain requirements for the years 2020 to 2022. And we endorsed that. That whole program was endorsed somewhere around about 2011 as well. So this issue of beneficial ownership within the FATF context builds on those commitments that we've made internationally. And we have a working group that reports to the IDC, called AML-CFT, and it's called the Interdepartmental Working Group on Beneficial Ownership Transparency. And that was a working group endorsed by Cabinet way back in 2015, and subsequently in 2021, Cabinet also approved that this working group now report to the IDC that is chaired by the National Treasury. So from that perspective, the work is continuing, and where are we at the moment? We are developing as the IDCBLT a national and integrated and also interoperable and harmonized registry framework that will enable the registries, and the emphasis is on registries, to provide access to law enforcement and other competent authorities via an integrated and harmonized, and the proposal is a two-tiered national BL framework comprising core, which could be our registries and key government BL information users and replicators. The thinking of the working group at the moment is to have two tiers. The first tier would comprise mainly of the corporate and legal persons beneficial ownership registry held by CIPC, supported by a BL trust registry under the various master's offices of the High Court. So those will be the provincial offices. They would be linked to the BO registry under SIPC, and that would be an integrated tier. Then importantly, there is a second tier, which we call the replicators. And there are several typical data in government and also asset repositories that will be the prime users of Tier 1 BO information. And these Tier 2 governmental agencies will then replicate the BO information that they would source through a connected channel, a pipe, electronically, we are envisioning. They would replicate that data within their own registries, which will enable, very importantly, a link of assets to the detail of the beneficial owner natural person. So it's not just a framework that South Africa is contemplating to hold of natural person information. We're also going to be linking it under Tier 2 to assets. And those assets would be found in the property deeds register, in the various deeds offices, and also then, obviously, which we have covered, the BL register for NPOs would also be linked. And we are also looking at other registries that perhaps hold assets that would form part of the network. Most importantly, the SARS dimension will also be available and would be a key and critical repository, as SARS requires all of this information, particularly not just natural persons, but natural persons linked to assets for tax collection purposes. So in short, South Africa has in its thinking, according to the committee, and we report as and when required to the IDC, particularly AMLT, chaired by the DG Treasury, as and when they have these meetings, our function is to report progress. So we do report, and there's oversight over what is happening in the IDC-BLT. The mechanism we are proposing at the moment is what is called a multi-pronged risk-based approach for effective implementation. And this is in line with the FATF standard and the latest FATF thinking as reflected in recommendation 24. So it will be a collection of beneficial ownership transparency information for legal persons and trust data in two core Tier 1 registries. And then there will be linkages to various government agencies, including SARS. Next page. So to talk about the issue which all the commentators have made and which has been fully taken on board in practice already, the design that we're contemplating is an interconnected registry or set of registries, Tier 1 for now, and it will also be based on a common data standard because the data needs to be interoperable, it needs to be read, digested and understood and then displayed for users in an integrated fashion. So Tier 1, our assessment is that SIPC has a centralized repository of basic legal information at the moment. It has yet to acquire beneficial ownership information, which is the purpose of these parliamentary proceedings. It's more advanced from a digital and data infrastructure perspective compared to the various digital capabilities residing in the provincial master's offices. We are in discussion with the Department of Justice that has ICT oversight of the various provincial master's offices, and we are very hopeful that with their cooperation we would be able to improve the actual data structure and the data being held in the various master's offices. So in our estimation, the CIPC would be able to more easily transition its ICT infrastructure to a BO registry platform. As it currently also largely verifies its basic data, the issue of verification for it would be built upon to then most importantly check and verify the beneficial ownership information once acquired, to ensure we meet the aspect of the statutory standard that is so important, the issue of accuracy, and that the information be up to date as well. However, this is not the case with the master's offices at present, and their article digital and ICT infrastructure, in our estimation, is in need of serious overhaul, and that's obviously an issue we are in discussion with and seek to have further discussions with the Justice Department on. So as an FIC have undertaken an assessment of trust data that is kept digitally in and or accessible from the master's office. And why is that so? It's because at present SARS and the FIC have MOUs with the master's office to receive trust data on request through a digital pipe, and SARS accesses that information near real time. The FIC is a bit delayed and accesses such data in the data dumps. The bottom line is we both have access to the master's office's data. We do know that the trust data has certain core deficiencies in just the data elements. In other words, the data that is actually being kept, and this would need substantial improvement and urgent enhancement we would submit once the bill, or should the bill be approved, to provide more meaningful trust data to SARS and FIC, which at present are the main operational users. Obviously, as competent authority, law enforcement would also utilize that information and once it becomes available. So in short, we are seeking to have a national perspective and integrated and interoperable and harmonized BO registry framework in place, which will require that the main contemplated BO registry be housed in a centralized CIPC and in various decentralized master's offices in provinces as it is currently. However, these should be all connected digitally and integrated by way of a common BO data standard. So we fully confirm what the industry and commentators have asked for. We have adopted that approach, and we are in the process of ensuring that we have the correct common data standard. In that regard, we can share. We are working with Companies House UK. We have met with them in September in a day session and to engage on that. We also have assistance from the EU, AMLCFD, or Technical Assistance Program, that would be working with the SA government and the IDCBOT to flesh out and deal with those issues. We also have been active engagement with Open Ownership on their data standards. So much work has been done on the data standard issue. So for us, and we believe it's in the interest of the country to ensure that the various registries tier one must be digitally connected in an ability to share data between them, to enable them also then to co-verify their data and to make their data available to the tier two and to the other persons that may be given lawful access to such data, which for now are the competent authorities and the various obliged entities. In other words, entities in the private sector, such as banks, which may require such data access to in order to better discharge their customer due diligence obligations. So these two systems must be interoperable and allow for these abilities of these registers to provide quality, and the emphasis is on verified information to government agencies and accountable institutions under the FIC Act, We have taken on board as a committee the request for the access of civil society and political role players other than competent authorities and accountable institutions, but as has been mentioned, those matters is subject to a broader consultation program. For now, we are focusing on the build, getting the ICT infrastructure done. Phase two in that concept, we will be moving shortly on the issue of access. So that is the report for now on where the registry framework is positioned in government at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christopher. So finally, we would just like to very briefly touch on the concerns that were noted in a number of submissions about the practicalities of listed company ownership. And so we certainly note the comments that were made, and we are certainly taking those very carefully into consideration to develop some appropriate refinements to the provisions in the Companies Act amendments that would be appropriate to address some of the concerns. It's intended that the proposals will seek to provide some flexibility in relation to the particular reporting requirements that may be applicable in relation to different categories of companies, especially the listed companies, and perhaps also provide for a differentiated approach in relation to the manner of reporting that may be applicable, taking into consideration aspects such as the nature of information that's available, where information currently is already provided, et cetera, and reported, so that overall for different categories of companies, appropriate reporting requirements could be provided for. It will be taken into account where there is other alternative reliable sources of relevant information that may be available and seek to sort of draw upon those sources of information. We don't tend to favor the approach of providing for an outright complete exemption of listed companies, and rather we envisage that it will be sought to enable that appropriate requirements would be able to be set that would be reasonably implementable by listed companies, and more generally that the requirements that would be applicable would be appropriate in relation to all of the different categories of entities that need to be reporting. And this is to some extent why we, throughout the bill, we provided for regulations to set out a lot of the specifics of the requirements, as that is a means to provide for a more detailed, nuanced, and flexible approach in relation to setting some of the requirements, if it can be set in relation to certain categories of entities. It must ultimately be ensured, however, whether there's an exemption provided, a complete exemption provided or not, it must ultimately be ensured that beneficial ownership information as required to satisfy the FATF requirements is collected and ultimately be made available to the competent authorities and law enforcement agencies. And the current requirements for beneficial interest holders, do not meet that requirements. And so, there must be a provision provided for in the legislation in the Companies Act to ensure that the actual and are able to be complied with. And it's important to note that Section 56 of the Companies Act does not apply to all entities, and the disclosures required in terms of that section are subject to an entity meeting the criteria of being a regulated company. And so this means that the entity should be engaging in an affected transaction or if the takeover regulations apply to it. So we hope that this gives a bit of a general sense of our proposed approach to developing refinements to the Companies Act amendments in relation to reporting requirements, particularly for listed companies. And that concludes our presentation. Thank you very much, Chair and Honorable Members.
Okay. Dan Vukile, Christopher Janine, so that we can move to the next item.
Yes, I think our presentation is completed. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thanks. Then let's move to the next item. Thanks, Vukile, Janine, Chris, and the entire team from the FIC and also from Treasury for the comprehensive response. Let's now move to the stakeholders to make comments. We'll start with COSA to Alan, how much time are we allocating? Because now it's 12 minutes past 11. Usually we break at 12, but if we go beyond, there's no problem. Have we allocated time?
Yes, Chair, we've allocated 3 minutes each, so that's a total of 24 minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes each. Media requests that all of us who speak in this platform, unless we've got a serious problem of network wherever we are, we should put our video on, because this meeting is also live streamed and also covered by other media houses above that one of the parliament. COSATU, 3 minutes. Please time yourself.
Sure. Good morning, Comrade Chair, honorable members, and their colleagues. No, I'm back, Comrade Chair, and it was a joint submission by COSATU and SACTU, our affiliates. So, Chair, I think we want to note the responses and the commitment to provide revised wording from Treasury colleagues as positive. And, you know, of course, Chair, as you said in the beginning, that as COSATU, as organized labor, we support the bill, and we are sensitive to the quite tight time frames which all of us want to ensure compliance with without undermining the progressive objectives. I think, Chair, though, for us, we're quite concerned, and we still are quite concerned, even listening to Treasury, that we think we do need to do some significant tightening around the beneficial ownership issues, and in particular around three issues. We do welcome the Committee of Treasury to come with a revised wording around the definitions. So let's see the details, but that's positive. You know, we always welcome the issue that some things need to be in regulations, and we're happy to engage on that. But I think, Chair, what's critical for us is that to avoid unnecessary litigation by people who might be opposed to the transparency requirements of the bill, we should make sure that whatever we put in regulations has a foundation in the bill. Otherwise, we might find ourselves in just serious trouble down the road. So let's make sure everything is in the bill. Chair, we welcome the issue of sharing information between government organs as critical. A single online portal for government to share, et cetera, is good. But we've also seen, Chair, when government doesn't take the issue of resourcing or capacitation seriously, it can collapse the registry. We have a sex offenders registry, which is barely functional because of this kind of issues. And Chair, just around the three specific beneficial ownership issues, one is around the issue of natural persons, who must require the natural persons' details to be disclosed at all times. So we know who are the real owners of a company or a trust, et cetera. So in simple English, Comrade Chair, would be, let's know who are the warm bodies who own these companies or entities, et cetera. Let's not allow anyone to hide behind issues. We think, Chair, it's also fundamental that the registry, you have a single online portal, and the bill needs to be significantly tightened to require access be made available to the public without qualification. It's critical that it be provided for so that the media, the trade unions, civil society, whoever wants it, political parties, can access information 24/7 without having to go through all sorts of red tape. Chair, there seems to be a kind of a bit of a backtracking by government side about including this, and we think this is quite alarming. Having the bill will not be sufficient. It needs to be, having the regulation is not enough. It needs to be the bill itself. And Chair, you know, the FATF said it's up to countries to decide. They're focusing on money laundering and terrorism financing, which is fine. We support that. But Chair, we come from a context of South Africa where we have lost billions of state funds, revenue to corruption, to state capture, to tax evasion, to tender fraud, to BE fronting. This has come at the cost of workers' jobs, workers' salaries. It's come at the cost of quality public services to an economy which is really on its knees. We don't think we can afford care to leave this one lying. There must be guaranteed access by the public to the information in an easy platform. So we're also quite surprised that business seems to be quite hypocritical on this. Business is quick to demand that governments be transparent, correctly so, the government disclose everything. But when it comes to business doing likewise, they seem to be running away and creating all sorts of nonsensical bureaucratic excuses. Transparency must go both ways. It must go to government, it must go to the private sector too. And we should not forget that most private sector companies are funded by workers' pension funds, by workers' monies. Sure, the last one is around the issue of listed companies' exemption provisions. We think that's a very dangerous precedent. We think it might actually end up collapsing the progressive bills and objectives of the bill. It might end up opening us to serious abuse in it. And you might even find that the FATF was just simply saying, well, South Africa is not serious about these issues. We're creating giant gaps, which we think really, in essence, that we shouldn't have any exemption for any companies. And somebody shared that natural person must include the real owners, the warm bodies. The registry must be made available to the public at all times. And in fact, there's provision for that in the company's management bill, chairs. We're not sure why Treasury is now seemingly to go against the company's management bill, which business support and NEDLAC as well. And chair, there should be no exemption for any company. So I think, chair, let me stop there. I hope I've kept to the time frame and raised these three serious concerns and fears from our part as COSATU and SACATU. Thanks, chair.
Thanks, Comrade Matthew. Ama Bungan in Corruption Watch, over to you. 3 minutes, please time yourself.
Great, thanks. Thanks, Chair. I'm Caroline James and I'm speaking on behalf of Ama Bungani and Corruption Watch. I think I'd like to echo COSATU's comments that we are pleased to see some of the comments and submissions taken into account, but also their comments that we're disappointed in the sort of continued reliance merely on FATF's minimum requirements. I think it's very important to recognize that while we need to meet FATF's requirements, the legislation that must be passed here must still be applicable to the South African context. And we can't have mechanical adherence to simply the minimum standards from FATF. What we really want to see is a recognition of both South Africa's constitutional obligations to transparency, openness and accountability, but also to ensure that the legislation responds to the reality that we've seen over the last few years of state capture and incredible financial crimes and just an inability to monitor and ensure accountability for that. So I think in that respect, we are disappointed to see that there isn't greater recognition of the need for public access to the information that's dealt with in this bill. We have to be focusing on the need for transparency and accountability, and simply saying that FATF doesn't require minimum mandatory public access isn't sufficient in the South African context with those constitutional imperatives and our history. And it's also disappointing that the bill removes an existing right to access the share registers without ensuring that there is continued protection of that right. So I think we'd also just like to emphasize that without an explicit protection of the right of public access to this information in this bill, it is likely that these pieces of legislation will be litigated on, which may just continually draw out the ability of the government to respond to FATF's considerations. And then I'd also just like to focus on the discussion around nominee arrangements. Again, this is something that is particularly relevant to South Africa and the history that we've seen with the corruption and the structures of corruption within the country recently. And I think that it is important that rather than just relying on again, the minimum requirements for FATF, that Parliament and Treasury really engage with the best way in which South Africa can respond to nominees and implement a regulating framework that is far stronger and will remove that loophole for corruption in the country. I think those are our main points, so I'll end there, but thank you for the opportunity to respond, Chair.
Thank you very much, Caroline, on behalf of Ama Bunga and Corruption Watch. NPO Working Group, over to you. Please time yourself.
Hi, thanks, Chair. Yes, I'll be brief. Nicole Copley from NGO Law here with my NGO working group hat on. We are first off relieved and delighted with the switch to a focused risk-based approach using the SATIS functional definition of a non-profit instead of mandatory sweeping registration for all. In terms of the comments made today, a multi-pronged approach is supported with data being held by relevant institutions and also, given the sector we work in, a tailored approach to beneficial ownership and consideration being given to privacy rights, particularly of beneficiaries of nonprofits, is appreciated. Just one note is that our submission regarding CIPC registration was suggested as an alternative to compulsory in nonprofit organization registration for at-risk profits at this time. I think this option is still preferred, and the earlier comments made around the systems and capacities of CIPC, I think, would support that. We're still tweaking that, and we will be making further submissions with details on that and other ideas we've had. The parallel process that's going on to conduct a full scan of the NGO sector and assess risks is supported. The timing of that is somewhat puzzling to us. Over the longer term, we do support a move of the NPO registry out of DSD into an independent, public, properly funded, credible and operational structure, or that the sector builds a new independent and credible institution. But that is not something which can be tackled right now. And so we are happy to give our submissions and make sure that we have a working order and enforceable, effective bill that can avert grey listing in the short term, if at all possible. Thank you. And thank you for the significant airtime and consideration given to the proposals from the sector. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nicole, on behalf of the NPOs. Freedom of Religion, SA, over to you, 3 minutes.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on National Treasury's input. While Freedom of Religion South Africa for SA welcomes some of the proposals tabled by the National Treasury today, such as, for example, the change to the NPO Act to prevent the DSD from getting involved in religious organizations' founding documents. Something that concerns for SA, though, about the Treasury presentation is that the SDSD registration for NPOs that send money overseas, is it even the right solution to stop terrorism funding? In other words, is DSD even the correct entity? Surely this whole thing is something that SARS, for example, is better equipped or capacitated, skilled to catch. And naturally, this, whether or not DSD is even the correct entity, whether this is the right solution for the problem, is something that would affect the Section 36 General Limitation Clause test for the rights affected, religious freedom, freedom of association, Section 31's rights for religious communities to establish religious associations. The concern regarding the duplication of duty on NPOs still exists. For example, NPCs, trusts, and PBOs who will need to report to SIPC, SARS, and the Master's Office while also now having to comply with DSD. From specifically a religious freedom perspective, I wish to point out to the committee members that many religious organizations support other religious organizations or missionaries in other countries. So, for example, with COVID that just ended earlier this year, many churches set up COVID relief funds for humanitarian work in other countries such as Malawi. Thus, even with what the Treasury is proposing now, many religious organizations will still have to mandatory register with DSD or risk falling foul of the law. And our endeavor is that the committee needs to think about whether government wants to make the DSD the responsible entity for catching terrorism funding and what the test for at-risk organizations will be. It can't just be that they send money overseas. Is it money over a certain amount? Is it money into certain countries? Is it money to certain entities? These are our inputs, and thank you very much for the time allocated.
Thanks, Danielle, on behalf of Freedom of Religion, SA. Cause for Justice, Over to you.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Liesl Pretorius on behalf of Call for Justice. Just want to reiterate that we support the overall objectives of the bill relating to preventing and combating money laundering and terrorism financing, and also avoiding South Africa being grey-listed. But we are concerned about detrimental unintended consequences. We support that there's a more risk-based approach to NPOs, that all NPOs are not treated the same, and that for a greater number of NPOs, registration will be voluntary. And also the tightening of the definitions of office bearer and a reassessment of appropriate penalties. But as my learned colleague from Freedom of Religion South Africa has just mentioned, from a religious freedom perspective, many churches render services overseas or make donations, sending missionaries, missionary teams, and supporting other church or religious organizations overseas, and they will still be captured by this act, and there will be mandatory registration. So the mere fact that a church organization makes a donation or renders services overseas, that mere fact can't bring that NPO under the ambit of this act. That needs to be reassessed. And also, we echo the sentiment whether DSD is the correct department to assess the risk, or rather look at whether money laundering is taking place. It would be better suited to a more finance-orientated institution such as SARS. These are our preliminary remarks, and we thank the committee for the opportunity to participate in these proceedings. Thank you.
Thanks, Liesl. Call for Justice. Let's move to Media Monitoring Africa. Over to you. 3 minutes. Alan Wusha, the colleagues from MMA in the platform.
It doesn't look like they're online, Chair. I'll just check, but maybe just move on to the next one.
Okay. Open ownership.
Thank you so much, Chairperson and Committee. First of all, thank you so much to National Treasury as well as the Financial Intelligence Center for a very thoughtful and considered response to the comments on the legislation. I just want to sort of highlight three things. First, with open ownership, we welcome the decision to review the definition of beneficial ownership in the bill. We do recognize that definitions are probably one of the hardest aspects of implementing beneficial ownership reforms. I think we do still say that in our initial comments that having that harmonized approach was the correct one. So, for example, in the UK, you see that the persons of significant control register is harmonized with the AML legislation. And this is important, for example, where discrepancy reports, where there are different disclosure regimes, are multiplied just because you don't have a harmonized approach. So I think as much as there is, we do welcome the move to correct or strengthen the definition, still considering some kind of harmonization will be important. We also really welcome the continued commitment from the IDC as well as the Financial Intelligence Center and other departments to have a common reporting standard. This will really put South Africa in a position to be one of the leading jurisdictions if implemented with regard to having common reporting standards and really be amongst those leading, including the United Kingdom, Armenia, Slovakia, as well as Nigeria, who have got a common data reporting standard, which really assists with the usability of data. And it's also beyond just the registries being connected. It's also important for the use of BO data for other purposes, such as in public procurement or in asset recovery matters. Finally, I want to turn my attention to the discussion around the treatment of listed companies. And I think in our initial submission, we said that there were mechanisms to ensure that the administrative burden is not placed on listed companies, but ensuring that it doesn't create an undue loophole. It is, again, quite a complex area for implementation. And perhaps the wording of exemption doesn't quite capture what we're saying. I think what we're saying is that if there is an alternative adequate mechanism for listed companies to disclose in a way that doesn't then make them unduly restricted, then that could be a choice to that could be a policy option that is well considered. The key thing here, particularly around the purposes of making sure that this data is easily and adequately available to competent as well as law enforcement authorities, is to make sure that wherever this data is ultimately held, it's held centrally. So, for example, it wouldn't be adequate for this information to be purely held by listed companies themselves, because that would mean that in the case of investigation or for other accessibility uses, it would mean having to go company to company in order to collate that information. We do also recognize that in South Africa, there's more than one exchange. And so what in our guidance we've looked at both globally as well as domestically is to say that where listed companies are exempted from a particular disclosure regime, this, there should be some kind of mechanism to ensure that where this happens, the adequate disclosure regime is monitored and assessed on a case-by-case basis across different exchanges as well. So those, I think, are three broad comments. But again, we do welcome the comments and presentations made by National Treasury and the Financial Intelligence Center and remain available to provide further inputs as well as commentary on the revisions that are being made. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Karel, on behalf of Open Ownership. Over to JSE.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Committee, members of the Committee, National Treasury, the FIC and the other stakeholders. The JSE appreciates the opportunity to comment on National Treasury's responses to the bill. We'd like to reiterate our support for the bill and the efforts by government to avoid grey listing, as we recognise the economic and reputational impact on South Africa. We are encouraged that certain of our comments have been considered, particularly the ones that recognise the practical difficulties a listed company would have in implementation of the requirements in the current version of the bill. Without sight of the explicit amendments proposed by National Treasury, we are unable to comment on whether the amendments will in fact alleviate the undue burden on listed companies. But we look forward to the presentation of those amendments to the committee and further engagement with National Treasury, SIPC and the FIC. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Anne, on behalf of JSE. Alan, the MMA now connected?
No. Chair, no, I don't see anybody online. I've searched all the names that I sent emails to, but I can't seem to find any of them.
Okay. Let's move to... thanks, participants, for your inputs. Let's move now to item 4, interaction by committee. Colleagues, over to comments or clarity-seeking questions. This is Dr. George, Pastor Steve is also on the platform. I can see your hand. Over to you, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd just like some clarity on the role of the Department of Social Development here. Is it proposed that they are going to be somehow monitoring financial flows in non-profit organizations to inhibit money laundering, etc.? I have very serious misgivings about that, because we all know that the Department of Social Development battles to pay the basic grants. So I have zero confidence in that if that is the plan. So I would like some feedback on that. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. George. Pastor Steve?
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the submission. And we do appreciate that there have been some concessions made. Obviously, one will need to look at the wording when it comes to the NPO sector, but obviously one also has concerns about the role of social development itself. And I really want Treasury to look very carefully at that. I'm also concerned about the costing of the bill, because we know that social development and others already have severe budgetary constraints. And I don't think it's sufficient just to say there will be budgets provided, although this is, I suppose, National Treasury. But we know that there are financial constraints facing all of us. And the concern is that there should be a proper costing of the bill. I do obviously want to appreciate that we want to avoid grey listing. All of us want to. But the unintended consequences, I think, as set out by some of the stakeholders, when it comes to the broader sectors, when it comes to the religious sector and international donations that are many, many churches and other faith-based organizations are involved in that. And that will then result in a mandatory form of registration. And that could go against the doctrine of entanglement, which is set out already in our case law. And I think Treasury needs to be very mindful of that. One wants to avoid a situation where you're having litigation, particularly when it comes to the religious sector, whilst bearing in mind the need to pass this legislation. But I think these are some aspects. I think at this stage, we appreciate the engagement and we look forward to the specific wording of the proposals that will come. And then one's got to consider that. Is it far enough to protect the different, particularly the NPA sector and faith-based organizations? And then will Section 36, when one strikes that balance, will it be sufficient? So thank you, Chair, from my perspective.
Thanks, Pastor Steve. Honorable Sarupen, then I'll come to Honorable Abraham. Over to you, Sarupen.
Thank you very much, Chair and Chair. Apologies for the video, but I've just been hit with load shedding and my connectivity is unstable, so I hope you can all hear me. Chairperson, just with regards to a lot of the submissions, particularly from NPOs, it is very clear that the NPO sector has made their submissions the view to saying that the finance matters would better be handled by Treasury, by SARS, registration by CIPC, et cetera, and not by DSD. And I think, Chair, we must also consider the unintended consequences of this. A lot of the NPOs fulfill functions that, quite frankly, social development is incapable of doing. HIV AIDS programs and counseling, old age care, frail care, et cetera, and they fulfill these roles off donations from across the country and across the world, and they do so with far more efficacy than the state has proven itself capable of doing. And we must be careful not to cripple across society a lot of good work and the consequences, unintended consequences of this bill. And so we've got to look at what the problem is that we're trying to solve. And the problem we're trying to solve is terrorist financing. So I'd urge Treasury to reconsider how they're bringing DSD into the General Laws Amendment Bill. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Sarpe. Noxie, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me apologize up front for my video. I'm experiencing load shedding in our farming town, Kredok. I hope that apology is accepted, Chair. Chairperson, maybe one should really appreciate the responses that have come from National Treasury. I even want to say that the responses were so extensive that it was for me one of the first experiences that I've had with Treasury answering with diligence each and every question that has been raised. I really appreciate that. Firstly, Chair, for me, I would like the National Treasury officials to talk to the issue of time frames. The reason why I want them to talk to the time frames for submissions on the bill itself is because of the next point I have on public participation, because I want to understand whether there has been some extensive and broad public participation beyond what we have here as the portfolio committee in terms of the public input in the bill itself and their views in as far as they are also affected by the bill. And then my third question is around the interdepartmental cooperation. I think Honorable Dr. George has talked to the issue of one department, but I would like National Treasury to talk to us in terms of the various departments that they have been interacting with, working on this particular bill, and what the progress is on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Vukile, Chris, Janine, can you respond to some of the clarity-seeking questions from honorable members?
Thank you, Chair. I will certainly be asking colleagues as well to help in certain areas, especially where I have overlooked or haven't answered it fully. Chair, let me start with the last question on the process. So, Chair, as you would be aware, I think we may have presented this in our initial presentation. The report itself, the mutual evaluation report, was published around the middle to the end of 2021. We have then, through engagements with cabinet directing the IDC, the Interdepartmental Committee to Coordinate a Response, that structure, honourable member, includes all necessary and affected government departments and agencies, including prosecution agencies and investigative agencies that are necessary to address all the identified shortcomings in the mutual evaluation, to coordinate through or at least under the chairmanship of the Director General of the National Treasury, who of course reports to the Minister of Finance, who is the cabinet level member of the executive responsible for overall coordination for the mutual evaluation, and we have been engaging on multiple occasions with cabinet, including providing regular feedback. So in essence, our coordination with other departments has been extensive in both the pillar that I spoke about earlier. So on this pillar, which is the legislative and regulatory amendments required to address what are identified as technical deficiencies, but as well as the other subset of improvements that we need to make to improve overall effectiveness. So that honourable member, I hope, gives you a sense of the coordination within the executive since 2021, when the report was made available, or published rather. Then, Chair, there was a very good question around the hampering the very important work that MPOs are doing currently. And Chair, I think that this is a very important point. You know, clearly MPOs are a critical sector in civil society. They provide a huge amount of support to the most vulnerable, and we are incredibly mindful of making sure that what we what we do doesn't unnecessarily or hamper the excellent work that they do. So you members would have noted that in our submissions we had identified a narrowing of the universe for that would be required to register, and that I think would exclude the, in particular the examples provided, those entities doing work in support of social, important and indispensable social causes within South Africa, and rather focusing on those that have a cross-border dimension. That is not to say that those who undertake cross-border work should be unduly constrained, but clearly there is an additional dimension of risk and therefore oversight that's required to ensure that those who are facilitating terrorist financing and other bad outcomes are identified. So it's not about stopping those activities. It's trying to, as much as possible, identify the risk and have a proportionate and commensurate response to where those risks are located. Chair, finally, there have been quite a few comments on the narrow role of the Department of Social Development, of course, which does a huge amount of excellent work, and we've worked very well and very closely with them. But perhaps just to underscore, Chair, that they will be responsible for retaining, they will not be monitoring financial flows, Chair. Rather, they will be maintaining the register itself in line with their principal mandate. The regulatory entities responsible for monitoring financial flows will be the departments, or the entities rather, whose focus will be on analyzing and taking appropriate action in relation to those financial flows. Let me stop there and maybe call on Janine to add where I may have omitted or not answered fully before checking with our FIC colleagues and handing it back to you, Chair. Janine?
Thank you very much, Chair and Vukile, and thank you to honourable members. With respect to the constitutional concerns that have been noted in the submission and were noted in the queries from Honourable Swart, we certainly, take those concerns very seriously, and we're conducting very careful constitutional analysis in relation to those issues that have been highlighted in the submissions. And certainly we will be formulating our proposals that we will submit to the very thorough analysis of the constitutional issues and seeking to develop proposals that would be constitutionally compliant. Because certainly, as has been noted, we certainly do want to avoid enacting legislation that will potentially be likely subject to constitutional challenge. So we really want to ensure that what is ultimately enacted would not have any significant risk for constitutional challenge. And we certainly appreciate the submissions that have been made today and the very constructive comments from the stakeholders in the meeting today. And we've certainly noted their further comments and the outstanding concerns that they've highlighted to the committee. And we will certainly take those into further consideration, in further developing our proposals in relation to refinements to the bill. So we certainly appreciate the very constructive and very helpful comments that have been made. And so we certainly noted those. And I think as Bukile noted, with the information, the role of the Department of Social Development, we certainly note the concerns in the submissions about the capacity of the department and how it can be addressed, and what is the appropriate mechanism, you know, for handling these various responsibilities in the legislation. So we certainly take those comments on board, but certainly, you know, the really complex money laundering analysis and monitoring of financial flows will certainly be undertaken by the appropriate regulatory authorities, and primarily the register that's established is mainly to ensure that there is information that is collected and is accessible, that's able to be used by the authorities in conducting their investigations. And just further on the point about interdepartmental cooperation, in the actual development of the bill, we have been engaging with colleagues from the Department of Justice, Social Development, the DTIC, Trade and Industry, and the CIPC, and then also in a broader legal working group, we've been also getting great assistance and advice from SARS and the NPA and the Civilians Police Secretariat and the financial sector regulators. So we've really had ongoing engagement with these entities throughout the process of development of the bill and during the consideration of the bill. The responses that have been submitted today in the comments matrix have also been compiled in conjunction with the colleagues from those entities, and many of them are on the call today. And we greatly appreciate their assistance and the work, which has been crucial for the development and processing of the bill. So we really appreciate that. In relation to the process for public consultation, Vukile may want to come in further on that, but I think we would note that there were the very urgent timeframes for developing the legislation, and so this particular parliamentary process is the key mechanism through which we are really receiving very important and helpful submissions on the legislation. And so we appreciate all of the stakeholders who have made submissions in the process to date. And we will certainly look forward to receiving the further submissions during this process. And we will engage and really consider all of the submissions very carefully, as they will be extremely valuable and helpful for finalizing the legislation helpfully and producing a sound and effective piece of legislation. So we greatly appreciate all of the stakeholders who make submissions into the process, and we certainly take all of their submissions and the insights that they provide very seriously, and we really take them into very careful consideration. I think that's all that I have to say. I don't know if Vukile would like to come in further. Thank you.
No, Chair. Thank you so much.
Are you done?
We are, Chair. Thank you so much.
Okay. I see Pastor Steve wants to make a follow-up.
Chair, thank you. If I may, I'm missing something here. And that is, if a NPO is already registered with the Masters or with the CPC or with SARS under a a public benefit organization or a volunteer association, why is it necessary? Can that registration not be used to cover them? It's an obvious question, but I'm missing it. I appreciate that they're not then registered in terms of the MPO Act, but would that not suffice, that existing registration? Thank you.
Thanks, Pastor Steve. Dr. George?
Thank you, Chairperson. My question exactly was quite similar to Honorable Swart's question. I mean, I asked the question as to whether the Department of Social Development is going to be involved somehow in arresting money laundering, etc. And that is not the case. So what they're doing is they're registering or something to the entity, and then I don't know what. So I can't see why they need to be in that process. And I agree with Honorable Swart that if they're already registered, well, then what is the problem? I am concerned that we are going to have a barely functional department involved in this process, what we are trying to do is make it easier. So we, I mean, you know, things haven't gone well, obviously, as we know, that's why we're here, but it certainly doesn't seem that it will make the process easier. One would think then that if there needs to be a registration, it should be registered then with a competent authority that is going to be looking closely at the money flow, for example. I mean, I don't know if it would fall with a FIC, but it could fall somewhere else, but certainly not the Department of Social Development. So I really don't understand why they've been injected into this process. It doesn't make any sense, frankly. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George. Treasurer can respond to those questions, follow-up questions by honorable members. And FIC. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Let me ask Janine to come in first, and I'll come in, I think, after her.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think with our most recent proposals, and I think Peter Smith from the FIC can also come in and assist, we have particularly also tried to focus on looking at trying to ensure that those who may pose risk, who may not already be registered under other registration mechanisms, would be appropriately registered under the NPO regulatory framework, because there are some voluntary organizations that wouldn't be registered as trusts or as companies, or they may not be captured under other registration mechanisms. But I think perhaps Peter could please come in on the requirement of recommendation 8, as perhaps it may be relevant for this particular question. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Janine. Yes, the point you made just now is certainly one of the key ones, that one of the key reasons why we have certainly considered the benefits of having institutions registered in the CIPC's records as not-for-profit companies or as charitable trusts, and where the master's office would have certain records of those. But in our view, that in itself is not sufficient. For one reason, as Janine just mentioned, that would only relate to institutions that choose to set themselves up in the form of a not-for-profit company or in the form of a trust. But then there would still be a category of institutions left that would perform the same activities, but choose to set themselves up in a different form, and that would then not require incorporation at the CIPC or registering a trust with a master. Additional reasons as well is that the NPO Act, the provisions of the NPO Act that relates to the registered NPO being required to have a constitution, certain requirements that constitution should meet, and having certain requirements for reporting on the activities and the financial management of registered NPOs. And very importantly, that an NPO is required to abide by its own constitution. Those are very important principles that are built into the NPO Act, and that currently is the mandate for the directorate, NPO directorate in the DSD, to supervise in respect of the NPOs that choose to register, and then have to comply with those requirements as a consequence of their registration. Those are the fundamental principles that are really the protection mechanisms that enable an NPO to protect itself from exploitation, from abuse by people that reduce the front of the NPO to raise funds and then divert the funds without the NPO's knowledge or involvement necessarily once the flow of funds is no longer under the control of the NPO. That ability of an NPO to position itself as an NPO that gives it the ability to raise funds from a donor community is an important aspect for an NPO that requires this form of regulation that the NPO Act provides for, and that enables the protection for the NPO. It's for that reason that we are looking at including the registration process of the NPO Act in the framework of measures that will be used to protect the NPO sector from this form of abuse. So that the purpose of this amendment in the NPO Act is not specifically for the NPO director to become part of an investigator for security apparatus. That is the responsibility of other agencies, and that those agencies do have access to the information on NPOs that is contained with the NPO directorate, as well as the SCIPC and the Master's Office, etc. But there's an additional aspect, I think, that we're trying to accommodate, and that is one of the very specific requirements that the FATF Recommendation Act requires of countries to implement their recommendations relating to NPOs, this aspect of supervision the activities of NPOs in respect of their own constitutions, in respect of their own charitable work, for the purpose of regulating the NPO, not the form in which the NPO is registered. So I hope that gives a bit more background to the thought process of why that we believe the NPO is a component of a framework that is required, but it's not the only entity that is solely responsible for addressing money laundering risk or terror financing risk in the potential abuse of NPOs. Thank you, Jenny. I'll hand back to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think we've completed response on that question.
Alan, before I conclude and close the meeting, are there announcements?
No, Chair, no announcements. Obviously, just to say that the proposed meeting on National Treasury's annual report, SARS, and then the briefing by the AG on the audit outcomes had to be postponed because National Treasury's annual report won't be tabled before tomorrow. So, yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much, honorable members, and also let me thank the stakeholders for their submissions, oral and in a written form. And as I've indicated right at the beginning, that we have extended the time frame for submissions to the 25th, and then on the 28th, Treasury, FIC, and other agencies will come back to respond to the submissions. And also, just to say that we don't have to be reminded by FATF to fight anti-money laundering and terrorism. It is our responsibility as South Africans that we have to fight terrorists. We can't allow our country to be a hive of terrorist activities. So that should be our resolve as citizens of this country. And let's also indicate that compliance to FATF is not only a matter of government. NPOs, NGOs, business must make sure that they comply. It's a societal matter. This is a very important matter that we are dealing with before us here. And let's also make sure that we should not make public statements which suggest that it is a fait accompli that South Africa will be greylisted. That does not augur well for the image of our country out there. Let's work together as South Africans to avoid greylisting because we know that there will be dire consequences for the country if South Africa can be greylisted. We are going to find it very difficult to get investors coming to South Africa and South African banks doing business with other banks in the world, South African companies going out there and invest. And so the consequences will be very serious. And let's take this matter seriously so as a country. The way we are fighting GBV, it's not a matter only for police to fight GBV, but it's also a societal matter that we can't allow women and children to be terrorized in the manner that we are witnessing that. So we can't always be pinpointing police that what are you doing in terms of GBV? We should also ask ourselves as South Africans, what are we doing to these criminals whom every time you switch on the radio stations, TV channel, you hear about women being raped, children being killed. So there are issues that, as a fact, we have to take up together, work together as society to make sure that we deal with those issues. From the side of Parliament, we'll work very, very hard to make sure that we pass legislations and regulations that will strengthen compliance. And in that process, we'll make sure that the public is actively involved in the decision-making. We are not conducting public hearing for the sake of ticking the box, but we conduct public hearings so that the public should influence the decision or the outcome of the legislations and the regulations that Parliament is going to adopt. Thanks very much. We are going to meet again with the stakeholders on the 28th of this month. Thanks, colleagues. The meeting is adjourned.